Manipulation isn't what you think it is. It's not a blunt force weapon. It's a whisper dressed as a choice. A kiss that feels like consent, until you realize it rewired your entire sense of reality. I used to believe I was the one pulling the strings, studying cognitive psychology, mastering persuasion methods, deploying behavioral tactics like a virtuoso. But then I met her, the woman who taught me that the real game isn't about controlling others. It's about making them think they were never controlled at all. What started in a university lab spiraled into a global conspiracy of offshore accounts, emotional recalibration, and dark psychological warfare. And now, I don't know if I exposed her, or if I just helped her win. This is the story of how I tried to dismantle the greatest algorithm of influence ever created, and ended up becoming its final version. If you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. The Lab of Lies. They thought it was just a class project. A few cameras, a questionnaire, and a clipboard, standard procedure for any upper-level behavioral psych course. But behind the mirror glass, I wasn't collecting data. I was performing an autopsy on the illusion of free will. The experiment was simple. 12 students. One stage decision. A bowl of red pills. A bowl of blue. I told them it was about taste preference. It wasn't. It was about control. How to create a situation where people believe they're choosing, when every variable has already been tuned to push them toward one outcome. The lighting favored the blue. The red bowl sat closer to the door. The temperature in the room nudged attention span. Even the assistant's body language, trained under my direction, was part of the script. 10 out of 12 chose red. Exactly as I'd designed. Not one question why. They signed the exit forms with shallow smiles. Some even thanked me. One girl giggled when she called it a fun little exercise in group behavior. I just nodded, jotting notes in my black leather journal. They didn't realize the real subject was choice itself. That night, alone in the lab with the security footage looping, I could hear the silence between every response, the moment hesitation formed, and I intervened invisibly with subtle persuasion methods. Mind racing, I felt something dark and electric unfold in my chest. I could scale this. That same month, I pitched my findings to a visiting think tank, disguised the manipulation as leadership optimization strategies. They ate it up, called it revolutionary, invited me to Geneva, said I had a gift for curated tales and cognitive exploration, said there were people, powerful people, who paid well for that kind of skill. I didn't hesitate. Geneva smelled like polished glass and quiet corruption. At the summit on global leadership strategy, the lobby was filled with gliding shadows, billionaires, defense contractors, biotech execs. The name tags were just for show. Everyone already knew who was who. Conversations were loaded with intelligence terms, offshore accounts, mitigation techniques, market dynamics, phrases that sounded sterile but reeked of dominance. I was just a panel guest, a boy in a suit two sizes too confident. But when I gave my talk, cognitive bias in high-pressure decision-making, the room stilled. Not because of my voice, but because I exposed something they recognized in themselves, that their power wasn't from wealth or title. It came from understanding people before people understood themselves. Afterward, a man from London pulled me aside, said my concepts reminded him of someone else. Celeste Farrow, he whispered. Ever heard of her? I hadn't, but I lied and said I had. That night, in my hotel room overlooking the lake, I searched everything about her. Dr. Celeste Farrow, professor of cognitive psychology, specialist in body intelligence, author of The Subtle Architecture of Persuasion. Her lectures were banned in some countries. Her work cited in intel on politicians and market manipulation cases. She was known for mixing psychological principles with something called celestial insights, framing behavioral support as both science and prophecy. A cult following, but no one really knew where she was. She only spoke at private gatherings now. Invitation-only events that required clearance. I didn't sleep that night. Not out of anxiety. Out of calculation. I needed to meet her. 3 weeks later, I got my chance. A friend of a friend slipped me a pass to a closed symposium in Berlin. Art and the Human Signal. It was called On the Surface, an event about art exploration and communication techniques in modern installations. But behind the buzzwords, it was a gathering of influence masters. The space was a repurposed cathedral. Candles flickered beside projection screens. There was no agenda, only atmosphere. And then she arrived. Not with guards, with presence. She wore a white coat over charcoal silk, her hair twisted like a crown of indifference. Her eyes scanned the room like heat sensors, measuring emotional temperatures, decoding cognitive behavior in every blink, every twitch. When she spoke, her voice slipped into the subconscious like a confession. Everything you call intuition is just pattern recognition born of trauma. The audience froze. I inhaled so deeply it hurt. That night, she gave a private demo. Not slides. A live manipulation. She picked a volunteer. A CEO from Singapore. Asked about his childhood. Within minutes, she had him confessing his mother's regrets, his secret fear of water, his choice to cancel an engagement no one knew about. All from three questions and reading his hand position. It wasn't a trick. It was engineering leadership using emotional fault lines. I was in awe and terrified. Afterward, I approached her, told her I admired her work on psychological warfare. She smirked. "That's not what I teach," she said. "I teach precision. Warfare is clumsy." I dropped a line about social dynamics and cognitive skills. She paused, looked at me, really looked. "You're not a student," she said. "No," I replied. "I'm what happens when students become labs." She smiled. "Come by tomorrow," she said, handing me a key card. "Room 404. That night, I stood in the hotel mirror and stared into my own reflection. I had never met someone who unnerved me. But she wasn't just smart. She was aware. She didn't manipulate people. She manipulated reality. And I had no idea what kind of shadowed secrets I was walking into. But I was already past the threshold, already tethered to something older, deeper, darker. I didn't want to win her trust. I wanted to dissect it. The mistress of minds. Her room didn't smell like perfume. It smelled like ink, melted plastic, and violet incense, burning slow behind a shelf of locked files. No bed. No TV. Just a wall of antique mirrors, a steel desk stacked with notebooks, and a floor covered in thick oriental rugs designed to absorb sound. Everything in the room whispered. This space doesn't rest, it listens. Dr. Celeste Farrow sat cross-legged on a leather meditation stool, scribbling something in what looked like Sanskrit on a tablet screen. She didn't look up. "You don't believe in silence," she said. "What makes you say that? You're already trying to fill it." She closed her tablet, lifted her eyes. "Tell me what you really want," she said. "Not an invitation. A test." I lied. "I want to understand the boundary between influence and control." She laughed, soft, dismissive. "There's no boundary. There's only skill." She rose with feline precision and walked past me, trailing the scent of sandalwood and ink. "Come," she said. "Let me show you how to fracture a man's soul using only a metronome." That night blurred like a fever dream. She led me to the sublevel beneath the symposium hall, a soundproofed cube lined with surveillance monitors, brainwave readers, and a massive glass wall that revealed another room. A controlled environment, she called it. The subject inside was already wired. An art dealer, blindfolded, hooked to a biometric chair. Celeste adjusted the lighting and began speaking into a microphone with a calm, seductive cadence. "Do you trust your memory?" she asked him. He didn't answer. He just nodded. "Good," she whispered. "Then let's break it." What followed was surgical. She layered audio manipulation with time-looping affirmations, ambient textures, and whispered contradictions. Over 30 minutes, the subject went from describing his childhood to doubting if he'd ever had a brother. When she was done, he asked if he could start again. Start life again. When the lights came back on, he wept. I didn't applaud. I asked how she knew he'd fracture. "Body intelligence," she said. "Microspasms in the left deltoid. Same as in betrayal victims. It's all pattern and emotional decision-making." She sat beside me in the dark and looked at the monitor like it was an altar. "You want to change the world," she said. "I want to redesign it." The weeks that followed were an immersion into madness and mastery. I shadowed her across Europe through closed-door experiments and real-world trials. In Oslo, we tested social manipulation at a tech summit by altering the digital signage, food smells, and temperature in different lounges. Delegates unknowingly confessed proprietary secrets while believing they were networking. In Marrakesh, we ran an influence lab, hidden inside an art gallery. Patrons were led through curated installations while wearing headbands that monitored market emotions. Using embedded speakers and oratory skills, we sold meaningless canvases for $60,000 apiece. She called it influence and art. I called it weaponized suggestion, but I was in too deep to resist. Every time she praised my intuition, I felt invincible. Every time she whispered corrections, I craved her approval. She never called it sex. She called it emotional calibration. The first time it happened was after a test in Lisbon, where a hedge fund executive confessed to embezzling 8 figures in front of a manipulated AI avatar. Back at her compound, she pulled me by the collar into her office and pressed me against the mirror wall. "Don't speak," she said. "Let your body answer." What followed wasn't intimacy. It was dissection. She kissed like a question. She climaxed like a punishment. Afterward, I lay on the rug, skin still buzzing from whatever incense she'd burned. She sat above me, legs folded, watching my chest rise and fall like data. "You process pain like a machine," she said. "But your breath betrays you." I didn't respond. I just turned away, unsure if I felt empowered or rewritten. She let me into her private lab 2 weeks later. It wasn't a lab. It was a vault, a converted monastery tucked into the Italian Alps, wired with motion sensors and guarded by former intelligence agents. Inside, there were binders marked human dynamics, influence cycles, and one that simply read, X's and O's. In the server room, she showed me her central thesis. Every personality is an equation. Solve the constants. Manipulate the variables. Control the result. It was all based on behavioral psychology, market psychology, cognitive strategies, and a new discipline she called signal weaving, a combination of language techniques, audio engineering, body language sequencing, and scent pulses. She'd created simulations for everything. Influencing juries. Undermining CEOs. Winning custody battles. Flipping elections. It was the psychology of crime dressed in research. And I loved it. Until the night she locked me out. No warning. No text. Just a dead key card and a silence that stretched too long. I stayed outside her lab for 6 hours before I received an anonymous message. "She knows what you've been logging. You're not the only one playing this game." The message came with a single attachment. A clip of me in her room, recorded from a hidden angle, staring at her sleeping form, notebook in hand. I don't remember recording it, but there I was. I watched it twice, then a third time. Then I realized she had manipulated me from the start. Every tool, every psychology tip, every time she whispered about letting go, she had engineered my belief that I was in control. And now she was watching. The algorithm of control. I didn't sleep for 2 days after that clip. It wasn't just the image of myself standing over her bed like a shadow. It was the part of me that believed it, that wondered if I'd done it, if she'd slipped something into my food, my air, my thoughts. She once told me that memory was a soft asset, pliable, strategic, susceptible to audio cues and spatial suggestion. Now I was the asset. Now I was the subject. And I had to know how deep the manipulation went. I bribed one of the server techs, Yari, a Turkish graduate student with a bad poker face and an addiction to PS1 emulators, to let me into the vault again. I told him I needed to cross-reference behavioral metrics. He didn't care. He just wanted access to Celeste's signal compression algorithm for his thesis. But I wasn't looking for data. I was looking for the root of control. Deep inside her archive, past walls of project folders, encrypted thumb drives, and handwritten flowcharts, was a hidden terminal encased in brushed steel. No fingerprints. No cables. Just a glowing input field that asked one question. "How would you like to be remembered?" I froze. That wasn't a password prompt. That was a psychological lock. A profiling key. I typed the first thing that came to mind. Strategist. Access granted. What opened was beyond code. It was a philosophy digitized. Annotated. Scripted in layers of human patterns, linguistic triggers, and emotional leverage systems. Her life's work distilled into what she called the algorithm of control. Not software. A psychological engine. A structure that could map a subject's emotional vulnerabilities and run scenarios for ethical persuasion, market manipulation, and even intimate dominance. It cross-referenced everything. Body intelligence, cognitive psychology, group behavior, behavioral support tools, and a field Celeste had quietly named signal identity fracturing. It didn't just analyze people. It redesigned them. I saw her notes on me. Codename, Sonnet. Defined under category. Influencer hybrid/latent threat. There were metrics. Charts. a segment titled Manipulative Personalities, Embedded Control Test. Subject believes he is the manipulator. In red, beneath it, subject will betray me and believe he's saving me. My throat clenched. Every encounter, every touch, every lesson had been pre-scripted. I wasn't her apprentice. I was her variable. That night, I drove to Montreux, far enough from her reach, close enough to run if she came for me. I crashed in a glass rental with auto-locking doors and motion sensors. But even there, I couldn't breathe. I felt her in the air, the scent of her incense, the rhythm of her pacing, the precise lilt of her voice echoing between the glass and my skull. I replayed old recordings, dissected every file she'd ever shared. And then I found it, a folder labeled EDR, Embedded Decision Reframing. Inside, real-world trial footage. Manipulations embedded in daily conversations. Examples of language exploration, subtle art, and trigger phrases designed to override critical thinking. Server room confessions. Boardroom reversals. Marriages flipped. And in one video, me, talking to an investor at the Marrakesh Gallery. Only, Celeste wasn't visible. Just a mirror behind me reflecting her hand gestures. Synchronizing with mine. Mirroring influence. I thought I was improvising. But I wasn't. She was driving me. She'd embedded mirror triggers. Gestural code synced with my speech cadence to force rapport. I'd become a vector for her agenda. But I wasn't broken. Not yet. I shut the laptop. Paste. Started sketching a plan. I would beat her at her own game. Reframe the frame. Use her tools, cognitive behavior, communication techniques, social dynamics, influence psychology, and turn the mirror back on her. I began crafting a narrative leak, tailored to trigger social suspicion, built on audio engineering, and injected with half-truths about financial scandals, offshore accounts, and unfiltered narratives. A buried byline in an anonymous podcast, designed to ignite speculation among her rivals and patrons. The weapon, doubt, the most insidious of all manipulators. When I returned to her facility 2 weeks later, I didn't knock. I walked straight into the symposium chamber mid-session, dressed in black, voice wired for confidence. Celeste Farrow, I said loud and calm, has been manipulating high-profile leaders under the guise of therapeutic exploration. And I have proof. Murmurs erupted. Phones lifted. Eyes flickered. She didn't flinch. She just stood. Calm. Elegant. Terrifying. You're exactly where I wanted you, she whispered as the cameras flashed. Why? I asked, the room shrinking. She stepped closer. Smiled. Because now, the algorithm isn't mine anymore. She looked to the crowd. It's ours. And in that moment, I knew I'd been baited again. But it was too late. Betrayal protocols. I don't remember walking off that stage. I only remember the feeling, that slow constriction in my chest, like a rope had been tied around my ribs and pulled from the inside out. She didn't need to disprove my accusations. She absorbed them, reframed them, repurposed them. Now the algorithm isn't mine anymore, it's ours. And with that single line, Celeste turned me from a whistleblower into a co-conspirator. I was part of her myth now. The days that followed felt like exile in plain sight. The leak had already gone viral. Not as an exposé, as a launch campaign. Celeste's followers, activists, consultants, media influencers, began quoting the exact phrases I had used as proof against her. Embedded decision reframing, body intelligence algorithms, emotional sovereignty. The very concepts I weaponized were now icons in a growing movement called cognitive liberation. She didn't fight the scandal. She branded it. And I was the proof of her power. I went underground. Rented an apartment in Bucharest under a false name. No cameras. No mirrors. No tech. Just notebooks, incense, and a loaded recorder. I needed to dissect my own psychology, layer by layer. Where had I surrendered control? Where had she installed the suggestion? How had she weaponized me against myself? I started logging cognitive behavior loops, mapping my reactions to external cues, scent, sound, language, lighting. I monitored my emotional responses, complex emotions, decision impulses. It was grueling. A self-autopsy in real time. And that's when I found it. One phrase. One whisper I kept hearing in my sleep. You will betray me and believe you're saving me. Not a warning. A program. Planted deep in my emotional memory matrix. I hadn't turned on her. I'd executed a protocol. I needed allies. I reached out to a former intelligence specialist I once met in Geneva, Adrian Faulkner. He was disavowed years ago for running a mind conditioning program during interrogations. Now he lived off the grid, teaching psychology of crime to underground operatives in backwoods Croatia. We met in a bunker beneath a ski resort. I told him everything. He didn't laugh. He nodded, then muttered, "She's using reverse game mastering. A mirrored construct. You never left the frame. You just think you did." He handed me a drive. Everything I have on manipulative personalities, dark psychology, social engineering, and ethical true crime mitigation techniques. But if you're going to kill this thing, you'll need to destroy the architecture. Not the architect. The architecture. The signal-weaving hub inside Celeste's core server room. I'd seen it. A steel-reinforced vault hidden beneath her Monaco facility. Temperature-controlled. Quantum-shielded. It wasn't just a data chamber. It was her cathedral. Her mind, externalized in code and scent and light. Getting in wasn't enough. I had to dismantle it live. Broadcast the disassembly. Rip the mask off while she was still watching. But to do that, I needed access. Which meant I had to return. To her. To the woman who turned my instincts into algorithms and my ambition into ammunition. I sent a message encrypted through her alumni channel. One line. "I'm ready to recalibrate." It took 47 minutes. Then a location. No signature. No name. Just the piano studio. 7 p.m. Come clean. The studio was silent. Dust motes swirled in golden shafts of light through cracked stained glass. A single grand piano stood in the center, its keys faded, its bench missing. She stood beside it, flawless as ever. Draped in black. No makeup. Just presence. "You came," she said. "I had to." She walked to the keys. Played one note. "G sharp," she whispered. The sound of internal betrayal. I stepped forward slowly, holding the drive in my hand like a peace offering. She didn't look at it. "You still don't get it, do you? Enlighten me." She smiled, a quiet, weary, devastating smile. "I didn't create the algorithm to manipulate the world," she said. "I created it to protect people from themselves. You were the one who turned it into a weapon." I froze. "You framed me," I said. "Used me." "No," she said. "I trained you. And then, you failed the test." I lunged, grabbed her wrist, pulled her in close, but she didn't resist. "You think this is about data," she whispered into my ear, "but it's about belief. Yours." And in that moment, I saw it. The room wasn't empty. It was wired, live streaming to every follower, every client, every convert. She'd staged it all again. One final manipulation. And I had just performed it for her. Inheritance of shadows. After the stream cut, there was only silence. I stood in the middle of the piano studio, drenched in sweat, heart echoing in my ears, eyes locked on a camera that was no longer blinking. The whole world had just watched me confront Celeste Farrow. And lose. Not because she stopped me, but because she made me perform exactly what she wanted them to see. The betrayer. The reckoning. The false prophet. All on cue. The stream had over 2.6 million live viewers. And by morning, it had been rebranded. A performance on power. Tagline. "He tried to destroy her. She used it to educate us all." She disappeared after that. No press. No trail. No digital residue. Some said she went deeper underground, crafting new layers of the algorithm in ring psychology circles. Others claimed she was in Iceland, building a behavioral AI that mimicked true body intelligence in real time. One rumor said she'd ascended into politics, whispering suggestions to people who made laws in her sleep. But I didn't care. Because the truth, I was no longer after her. I was after what she left behind. The algorithm wasn't gone. I found it buried inside a mirrored hard drive. A final copy Celeste had encrypted inside a melody. A piano key cipher hidden in our last performance. It unlocked a folder labeled Inheritance Protocols. Inside was a full schematic, her life's work. But with one difference. My name. Not as a subject. Not as a threat. As co-architect. Every note. Every variation. Every beta test we'd run together. Reframed in my voice. My data trails. My breath patterns. I hadn't just been her experiment. I'd been her mirror. Her partner. Her heir. And now her successor. I launched Orion Systems under a false identity, offering integrated emotional decision-making frameworks for global organizations. It sounded clinical. Neutral. Safe. But what we really offered was belief architecture, customized frameworks for social influence, group behavior shaping, and strategic perception engineering. We worked with billionaires, ministries, black budget agencies. No paper trail. All results. Every client asked the same question. Is it ethical? And I always answered the same way. Ethics are a user preference. Sometimes at night, I replay her voice, one of the many snippets I now own. The trick isn't to manipulate them. It's to teach them to manipulate themselves. And I wonder, is that what she wanted all along? Not to be followed, not even to be feared, but to be replaced. A system so fluid, so embedded in everyday human dynamics that no one could trace it anymore. Just choices, perfectly staged, perfectly believed. Now, when I walk into the labs, I don't feel like an imposter. I feel like an architect, one who knows the shadows and how to engineer the light around them. Because in the end, there is no such thing as freedom. There is only the illusion of choice. And I've learned to sell it better than anyone else.